Do you have any vices?
None.
What?
I am basically a
Data is
Victorian.
My name's Nate Cohn, and Data is my only vice.
I'm sure I have a vice.
That's a good Twitter tagline. Data,
how bad does
data
a vice
is my
have
only
to be?
Vice.
In today's day and age, how bad does a vice have to be to count as a vice?
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we have a treat for you all today. Here in studio, we have two Nates. So listeners are definitely familiar with one of the Nates, Nate Silver. Hi, how's it going?
I mean, they're familiar with both. Come on, our audience.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they're familiar with both, but just in case, also here with us is Nate Cohn from the New York Times. He covers elections and polling with the data journalism outfit, The Upshot. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also, of course, here with us is Claire Malone, senior politics writer. Hey, Claire.
Hey.
Micah is out today. But so let me explain why we have two Nates on the podcast today. So the New York Times, in collaboration with Siena College, recently released a round of battleground state polling that shows a much closer 2020 general election contest in swing states than you might expect if you just looked at national polling. That piqued our interest in the 538 office because it gets at a big theme from the 2016 election, the split between the popular vote and the outcome in the Electoral College. So today we're going to dig into the Times' latest polling, discuss who might have an advantage in the Electoral College in 2020, and also talk generally about the state of the Democratic primary. Looking forward to this. Thanks again for being here. This is so exciting.
It's very exciting.
I'm glad you share the excitement. So let's begin with you. And I think we're going to have to go with like last names here, right? So I'll call you Cohn. I'll call you Silver. I'll call you Claire.
Thank you. You can call me Malone if you want to. Malone is actually a
Malone's
very good like last
Malone.
Name.
Malone's a great name.
We got Silver.
I have a great name.
We got Cohn and we got Malone.
Silver, Cohn, and Malone.
Yeah, that sounds like a band.
Okay, come on.
I was thinking of basketball.
Yeah, who's going to play like the banjo in that
sounds
band?
Sounds like a, I don't know, like a polka band or like a...
okay, so Nate Cohn, you polled a hypothetical matchup between the leading Democrats and Trump in six swing states. Those are Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, Arizona, and North Carolina. You found Biden leading Trump by 2 points on average, Sanders tied, and Warren trailing by 2 points on average. And all of those leads are deficits are within the margin of error. So were you surprised at how close that result was given all of the national polling that we've seen that shows a much wider race?
Yeah, I was definitely surprised. You know, when we started this project, we actually had some second thoughts about whether it was a good moment to be conducting this poll, concerned that, you know, we'd come back and Trump would be so far behind that there wasn't much of a point of peering into some of the groups we were interested in looking at, like undecided or persuadable voters. I suppose that one critical question is what kind of national polling result would we expect based on these numbers? In my mind, you know, in 2016, these states were 4 points to the right of the country. In 2018, they were 5 points. And at least by our estimates, and this is more debatable, I suppose, because it's not based on a hard result, we think that among registered voters, the gap grows a little bit more to 6 points. So I think that based on our estimates, you would have maybe Warren up by 2 to 4 points nationally based on these numbers, depending on which of those three.
And
that
losing
range,
the Electoral College.
And losing the Electoral College. And I think based on our polls, you would say that Joe Biden was up somewhere between 6 and 8 points nationally, depending on which of those three options I gave you preferred. And that would be short of most of the national polling that we have at the moment.
So Malone and Silver, how does this jibe, and we'll begin with you, Claire, how does this jibe with your conception of the race nationally? Given, I mean, I think ABC just did polling where all of these candidates were up by double digits over Trump nationally.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as someone who spent a decent amount of time in like the Midwest this summer and I guess talking to Ohio relatives constantly, there is a certain sense that I do have where the race is a lot closer on the ground. And even if you talk to people in like Wisconsin and Michigan who are Democrats, right, and who might be inclined towards the politics of Warren, there's a huge kind of strategic element going on in the primary, right? And so there's this constant, but will my, you know, neighbors a couple counties over vote for Warren or vote for Biden? And most of them will say, yeah, they'll vote for Biden over Warren. So I do think that there's an interesting dichotomy between like the progressive activist conversation and frankly like the Twitter conversation, which I think a lot of campaigns are tuned into, and then the actual what people are feeling on the ground. And this kind of goes to the past 3 or so years of Democratic politics, which is the Overton window shifting ideas, the rise of, you know, the Sanders Medicare for All litmus test, you know, so there's a progressivism bubbling up, but also a lot of places just like their old school Democrats. And those places happen to be the Electoral College tipping point states. So, yeah, I think this polling is very interesting and jibes. And I think particularly some of the impeachment stuff was interesting. You know, people wanting to open an inquiry, but not necessarily impeach the president, which kind of speaks to, I think, the fuzziness that exists in some of these places.
Yeah, Nate, especially hearing what this would mean for the national picture, because we have more things to compare that against, right? We don't have a lot of swing state polling. Nate, how does this compare with how you're thinking about the state of the general election?
This is Nate Silver, by the way.
I'm
thinking about the primary right now. If you infer from these polls that, okay, Biden's up two-ish in these states, they're a little bit to the right of the national average, it would not be shocking to see a national poll showing Biden 5 or 6 points ahead. In fact, that's kind of well within the range of, it's on the lower end of the range, but there's a range that ranges from low single digit leads for Biden to mid double digit leads, mid teens, basically. And at this point, it's hard to nail down the electorate. The distinction between like adults versus registered voters versus likely voters is pretty important. I mean, I think the question is in part like, what does this mean for those kind of states in the Midwest, right? Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin in particular. Because some of the results actually aren't that bad. The Florida result for Democrats is a result that you might not mind. Biden plus two, Arizona, Biden plus five. And these are smaller sample sizes, right? So, you know, but if Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin are problematic again for Democrats, then the math becomes a lot harder electorally. And you might wonder about if Arizona's a plus five and Florida's a plus two, then what about Texas or Georgia? You start to ask questions like that. And this poll also, Iowa, you polled Iowa separately.
We did.
And those results were kind of closer than you might expect in Iowa. So there are like 12 different ways to interpret it. One thing I'd like to know is, are you guys planning to do like a national poll?
I think we are planning to do a national poll at some point. I also suspect at some point we're going to venture into Texas. I mean, you pointed out that Biden's up five in Arizona. That's a 9-point swing from Donald Trump's 4-point win. And Donald Trump won Texas by 9. So, you know, those states they're not exactly the same demographically, but in terms of the way we would expect them to be trending, I think that you would expect Biden to be running well ahead of Hillary Clinton there among registered voters, at least, and that would imply a pretty tight race there.
I mentioned some of this polling, but specifically ABC and the Washington Post came out with a set of national polls last week showing Biden up 17, Warren up 15, and Sanders up 14 over Trump. Of course, that's just one poll, just as this is just one poll. But do you think that given how different your picture of the country and the swing states and even the national environment looks, that there's something that your polling is picking up that other polls might not be picking up?
I do think that's possible. You know, I think that our polling has a lot going for it. I mean, that's the reason why we do it. I'm sure every pollster will give you a similar answer that, you know, advances their case for why they do things the way they do.
So give us your case.
So we have the advantage of having the right number of registered Democrats and Republicans in every state. We pay a lot of money, frankly, to reach lower turnout voters who are typically highly underrepresented in political surveys, and most polls don't weight on that either. And so we both oversample them and weight on it. We also are stratifying our samples, which means that when you look at a poll of Pennsylvania, for instance, not only do we have the right number of Democrats and Republicans, but we have the right number of registered Democrats and Republicans in every region, which if we were to do a random sample, would actually not necessarily work out and would lead to some very odd, has the potential to lead to some odd biases. And we also weight on education, which I should note is true of all of the national polls that we're comparing to right now, but is not true of a lot of the state polls still. And we are also on the lower end in terms of our educational estimate of the composition of registered voters. We're lower than what the Census Current Population Survey says because we rely on the American Community Survey. This is super nerdy, but I'm assuming that this is the kind of thing your audience is interested in.
Community Survey, we love it.
But basically, you know, not only is our estimate that the electorate is less educated than is assumed by a lot of state polls, it's also a little less educated than some of the state polls that are accounting for education, like a Marquette University survey or something.
And we actually just released our pollster ratings here at 538, and the New York Times Siena College poll did very well. You received an A+. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But hearing this in terms of thinking more deeply or just in a different way about the educational makeup of the electorate, Malone, Silver, like, what do you think about that strategy as a polling strategy?
I mean, so to the point of paying more money to get better samples of voters who are missed by normal polls is something that I think was well, frankly, an outlined strategy of the Trump campaign last time around, right? Reaching some of those low propensity voters. He had a lot of earned media reach, so he was getting people. So maybe there is something to the fact that we're in a moment where politics, I think, has become more part of the mainstream culture, and therefore you might have people who are more likely to turn out to vote who weren't part of the last couple of election cycles, right? And so I do think it's interesting to have that as a part of the sample, because I think that was a complaint from the 2016 election, is that those voters were missed and that that was a problem with the polls.
Yeah, in our 2016 polling, we had essentially the same sampling approach. We have been able to, you know, refine our approach with all the data that we've collected over the last few cycles, but the fundamentals are the same. And in our final polls, we found that these voters who did not turn out in 2016 or who hadn't voted in primaries were very different than the demographically similar voters who turned out in recent cycles with regularity. And we think that's part of the reason why, you know, at least in 2016, our polls were better for the president in some important states than some of the other polls that were out there.
It's worth mentioning, right, we've kind of driven home that the polling error in 2016 was not larger than the polling error in 2012. In fact, it was slightly smaller nationally. But when you look at specific states, there were state-level errors, which is where we lost kind of who was going to end up winning the Electoral College. I don't mean we, 538, or you, the New York Times, but kind of as a nation, the media, et cetera.
I mean that's part of it, though, is like, there were errors that went in opposite directions in 2016, right? There were actually states, California being an important one because it has so many people, where Clinton beat her polls by several points. I think she may have also beaten her polls in Texas and Arizona, some of the emerging kind of more multicultural states, right? So in the national polls, if she beats her polls by 5 or 6 points in California, that actually kind of balances the scale out a little bit for underperforming in the Midwest. I mean, again, but this is like the different point of view. Like for me, you know, I'm thinking in terms of more or less like, how do we build a model, right? And my principles are, okay, well, we kind of average all the polls together. We put more weight on the higher quality polls, including obviously Siena, New York Times, right? We think a lot about kind of how to weight and how to calibrate between having a more diverse set of perspectives and totally just waiting for the most important, or not most important, but like the highest quality poll. And I don't really care how the sauce is made, because in the long run, we know that it's hard to predict the direction of polling bias, right? That's a different perspective than if you actually have to conduct a poll. I mean, the last thing I would want any pollster to do is to say, we don't have to worry about bias because in the long run, bias is kind of unpredictable. So we'll just kind of do what we did last time, right? And usually when you kind of see that you have a year in 2018 where the polls were unbiased overall, although there were, again, problems in particular states and districts, some of which resembled 2016, right? That probably results, frankly, from some pollsters undercompensating for the last election and not changing enough, and frankly, maybe other pollsters overcompensating for last time, and that kind of tends to even out.
Can I ask for clarity for our listeners? So in the states that Cohn has polled, these battleground states, were there problems, and what were the problems in the polls in those states from 2016? Maybe just to talk specifically about, were there certain groups that were being missed, just to give people a sense?
I mean, clearly, if you're not waiting for education, then you have problems, right? And that's kind of, I think, the kind of fundamental sin of polling in 2016 was like education become a very big divide, obviously, in how people.
So non-college educated voters might have been missed.
Missed. I mean, he would know more, right? I mean, I think, I don't know if they're not picking up the phone as often.
Yeah, if we didn't weight by education, in these six battleground states, 45% of our respondents would have had a college degree.
Yeah.
We think that in these states, the registered voter population is about 33% with a degree.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference. And I would note, by the way, that this correlates not only with the general direction of error in the Midwest, but it does nationwide as well. In our polling, less educated Hispanic voters are more Democratic. Non-voting Hispanic voters are more Democratic. So if you have a poll that scrapes the top of the universe of potential respondents, high turnout voters, primary voters, affluent and well-educated voters, you would get the kind of pattern that Silver has described here. You would have an underestimate of Democrats in the Sun Belt because you're missing the most Democratic Hispanic voters, and you would have the reverse of that, the flip side of that in the Midwest. And I would note that in the polling that we've just done, we have a sort of similar pattern that plays out here where we think that Democrats are doing very well among registered voters in Arizona because we think Biden's up 50 points among Hispanic voters there. And we think that among likely voters, his advantage shrinks. While in the Midwest, we think that when you apply the likely voter gap, that Biden actually improves his standing in Michigan, because we think the low turnout voters there are, I'm not sure that they're conservative actually, but they seem to like, at least in our sample, they are very supportive of the president.
So, Nate, Silver, you said that like kind of it's not your job to pick through the different pollster strategies and ways that they weight, et cetera. You accept what the pollsters give you. But Cohn, you are now a pollster, right? So looking at the way that you do things in comparison to how other pollsters do things, do you think other pollsters are still making the mistakes of 2016, or do you think that pollsters have learned some lessons?
I think there are some pollsters that have learned some lessons.
We want names.
I think that the Monmouth poll weights by education. You know, that's a change for the better. There are some state polls that rely on random digit dialing that weight by education. I do not see very many pollsters that appear to be making a special effort to reach voters who don't have a track record of voting, which I think is, at least in our data, always shows up as something that is important, especially as you move down the educational spectrum, the low-educated voters who don't vote often are very good for the president among white voters, and it's the reverse for non-white voters. And I think that a lot of the most prolific state pollsters, and I would include in this, by the way, some of the online pollsters that are now releasing national state-level estimates based on national approval data, I'm concerned based on a variety of different factors that they may have a particular challenge reaching rural white voters. You know, I don't want to pick on people, but you know, like these Morning Consult and Civics polls, you know, they say that the president's approval rating is even in Nebraska right now. It's like, okay, maybe, but like maybe that just indicates that there's a real challenge, you know, getting to a certain kind of voter.
I want to dig into this a little more, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Here's a story. Cafe El Tura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, we're back. And Silver, something that you mentioned earlier that I want to dig into further is that in 2016, polls were underestimating Democrats in the Sun Belt, places like California, and overestimating Democrats in the Rust Belt. And this actually gets at what created a quite significant split in the Electoral College and popular vote. And this is something I know that the two of you have discussed online at some length, the possibility of another popular vote Electoral College split in 2020. So kind of I just want to turn it over to the two of you. Do you think at this point we can say whether or not a Republican advantage in the Electoral College is likely in 2020?
My view is that right now the president is as strong in the battleground states with respect to the country as he was in 2016. And I think that there's reason to think that it could be larger.
That split between the Electoral
yes.
College and the population.
And although I've taken up polling, I don't do much of the predictions. You know, my instinct would be that I would expect that to carry through for the next year. I think there are all sorts of ways that could change. I won't list all of them. But my prior is that the president will have an advantage in the Electoral College again.
Silver?
I mean, I'm trying to think about like literally what the prior we use in the model is, right? I think the prior in the model is you wait like 3/4 of the previous election and 1/4 of the election before that, or maybe 2/3 and 1/3. I forget what exactly. So that would kind of say, okay, clearly 2016 was a very good year for the president in the Electoral College, but there's some reversion to the mean, and actually 2012 was a better year for Democrats if somehow they're able to have a candidate who can kind of recreate that Obama coalition. So I think maybe it's a question of like where your priors are. You know, last year or 2016, if we're election geeks, we think last year means the last election sometimes, right?
Feels like last year.
So Clinton won the popular vote by 2.1 points, but the tipping point state was Wisconsin, which was at what, 0.8 points? So there's already a 3-point spread. So if you think, okay, it's the same as last time, then the default is a 3-point spread, which therefore means that 4 points or 5 points would not be so preposterous, right? If you think, okay, it's 3 points, but things get scrambled over 4 years, so therefore I revert it more to like 1 or 2 points, which is kind of what I do mentally, then I might say, yeah, then a 5-point spread is possible, but like a little bit less likely. You know, I think that the source of the argument on Twitter back this summer, whenever it was like, I don't know, like, how much precision it's possible to have at this stage without having a lot of different pollsters in a lot of different states, right? The distinction between registered voters and likely voters is fairly relevant. There are big pieces of the puzzle, like Texas that are, I mean, Texas, because they have so many people, is like actually quite important, accounting for uncertainty. Like, what if Texas looks a little bit worse than these other states for the Democratic nominee, but it's hard to poll, and there's a 1 in 5 chance that Texas is really good for Democrats, and if that's true, then they can lose all the other states, doesn't matter anymore, right? And so, like, I guess my objection is more like, I wouldn't want to try to design like a model this far out, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean you can't like have a valid discussion about the Electoral College and like...
So to clarify for listeners right now, Cohn is saying, right now I think the president is probably in a pretty good position of strength, in part because I think some of these voters are maybe undercounted in certain polls or their strength is more powerful.
Well, I think that the argument that the president seems to be doing better in the battleground states than he is nationally.
Yeah.
I think would probably hold regardless of methodology. Like, I just picked on, you know, the civics.
Sure.
Or the, you know, the civis, civics, sorry, it's civics, right?
The one civics with the Q. Yeah.
Civics with the Q. You know, they had their 50-state tracker, and, you know, right now they think the president's approval rating is even in Wisconsin or whatever. You know, I think that in the exit poll, the president's approval rating is -4 in Wisconsin. I think that regardless of where individual pollsters, you know, make their methodological choices, it seems to me that most of them show a persistent edge for the president.
And Silver, you're saying it's a bit too early to feel that confidence?
Yeah. I think, I mean, there are two slightly different things, right? One's probably saying that I am less willing to be moved off my prior stage. And the priors are, by the way, that you should expect there to be a Trump edge in the Electoral College, but maybe not as profound as in 2016.
Okay.
And it's probably more uncertainty. And then if you kind of take all the overlap of different states that are correlated in complicated ways, then that gets interesting. Because to some extent, like, conditional on the popular vote being a certain number, conditional on the Democrat winning the popular vote by 3 points, say, right? You get a little bit of a problem where if you increase the GOP vote in some areas,
right,
then areas that are opposite might actually move in the opposite direction. So it's like, so it's fairly complex. But look, I mean, like a lot of things in our world on social media and elsewhere, you know, I mean, if you kind of had to like boil the debate down in mathematical terms, right? You know, maybe I would be saying, oh, I think my expectations, there's a 2.4-point gap, and he'd be like, oh, I think it's 3.2 plus or minus some number, right? And it would not really sound that dramatic
necessarily. So you both think at this moment in time, would you at least say, Nate Silver, that there is an advantage for Republicans in the Electoral College right now,
Right now there's not an election, right? I mean, I'm pro-uncertainty. It wouldn't shock me if you had a 5-point spread. It wouldn't shock me if you somehow had Democrats have an advantage in the Electoral College because it happened in 2012, and I don't know what happens if Texas or Georgia get really weird.
One thing that I think is part of the reason why we split here, and I think that if you read both of our stuff, you'll notice that it's a broader difference in how the relative weight that we give to things, is that I think a lot about the demographics of these states, and that affects my prior. I think that if you had a strictly empirical view of it, where you said, okay, historically, what's the relationship between the Electoral College advantage in the prior election to the one in the next one, you would adopt the same basic philosophy that Silver has adopted here, and I think that's a totally reasonable approach. When I think about it, though, I am mindful of, over time, the country has become more diverse and the battleground states are less representative of the country. So to me, that means that there's more potential for the states to move in independent ways. And I would note, by the way, that the 538 model accounts for this in certain ways that I think are responsible for their electoral college, not quite prediction, but nod at or, you know, anticipation,
right,
of.
Like the Rust Belt states are connected
the 538
because they're demographically
model.
Similar.
Yeah, that's something that's built into the 538 model in important ways down the stretch. And I think that if you accept that has consequences for the way we think about it now, if you also think that the president appears to be maintaining either his strength among white working class voters, which, by the way, not all polls agree on, or you just think that the way that the president and the Democrats intend to campaign would be likelier to strengthen that demographic divide or deepen it. That's my interpretation of the respective strategy of the two parties. It's my interpretation of most of the election results that we see, which is every election night. Every election night, in case you need to retape that.
Okay. You
can swear.
You know, the Democrats do better in the suburbs than they did last time. They do worse in the rural areas than they did last time. And I think that that broad pattern would tend to exacerbate the advantage in the Electoral College, or deepen the difference in the Electoral College.
Nate Silver, you're saying that empirically, based on what Cohn's phrasing, you have certain priors about the past couple of elections. The Electoral College, certainly given the 2016 result, favors the president slightly. Now, do things like shifting, like white college-educated voters perhaps going more for Democrats in the midterms or the president's impeachment inquiry, does that play into like your thought process right now? Like, break, maybe use some of those.
Yeah, what are some of the unknowns?
What are some of the unknowns for listeners? Like, what's going on?
Well, I mean, start with the fact we don't know who the Democratic candidate would be.
Sure.
And so how much of Trump's relative strength among white working class voters was because of him versus Hillary? I mean,
Well, we kind of figure it out in this polling in some regards, right? One of the most interesting things that I read in your piece was, according to this poll, things have not changed since 2016 amongst the white working class. Like, the picture today is the picture that it was in 2016.
That's what we have. And in fairness, there are national polls that have a different take here. I mean, when you see the ABC Post poll or the Fox poll or whatever showing the, you know, Biden leading up 10, you know, I think the difference between the, you know, Biden plus 6 to 8 that I've argued our poll suggests and the Biden plus 10 or more that the national poll suggests, that those national polls think that there's attenuation in the president's strength among white working class voters that we didn't find. I do think, though, that in the midterm election that this pattern largely persisted. The Republicans got their white working class vote, at least in relative terms, back on board. You know, I would, but my personal expectation is that, you know, regardless of whether the polls find that vote undecided now, that much of it will return to the president.
What do you think about that?
I mean, look, I think their polling describes a highly plausible scenario where it's a very close election in the Electoral College, right? And then it may or may not be very close in the popular vote.
Whip it silver back too. You said,
I do love. I'm sorry, I can't get.
I know it's very funny. But you said. Okay, the unknowables, right? The known unknowns to be Rumsfeld.
Well, the known unknowns are like, so, why we don't even like.
Okay, no nominee.
It's going to be 6 months before we would even think about issuing a general election.
Sure, but some other things that people should be thinking about when they're maybe trying to inhabit your perspective on this. So we don't know the nominee yet. What else is sort of rumbling around?
I mean, everything. We don't know the state of the economy a year from now.
We don't know the state of certain demographics and how they'll lean, if they'll behave as
we
don't know.
So one thing that became in our model, at least over 2016, was that early on, in part because the model defaults more toward priors, mm-hmm. early on, I think it did show like a small electoral college edge for Trump, meaning that it thinks that, not that it had him favored, but it would think in a close race, he would be more likely to win the electoral college.
Right.
And that grew and became more apparent by September or so, right? So if you even throw apart the abstract debate over like what's it mean to poll right now, right? There is a campaign over the course of a year. It's certainly possible that the president will grow stronger or weaker with certain groups. I do think the precedent of the Kavanaugh hearings is one kind of precedent for impeachment that actually kind of led to more partisanship. You know, I don't know as much. I wonder if Cohen has opinions about like, what if you have turnout of 155 million people or something, because voter enthusiasm is quite high. Like if we get into that super, super duper high turnout category, then is there even a heuristic you use to say who that would help, or is it messy?
In our data, and almost all of what you read from us is based on our polling data. So it's worth noting that although we think it's very good, polls can disagree with each other, and it's not certain that we're right. But in our data, as you increase turnout, you exacerbate, you deepen the division that we're describing here, because the low turnout white voters in the North, we think, are pretty receptive to the president. And we think that in the Sun Belt and in non-competitive states, not only are there more low turnout voters, because those are just lower turnout states in general, but we think that those low turnout voters are more receptive to Democrats, low education Hispanic voters, for instance. So when we simulate this, and it should be noted that simulation is not what actually happens in elections. You have the, you know, Obama just plucked out a bunch of low turnout black voters and added them to the electorate. And that has a distinct consequence for the Electoral College that is different from a gradual increase in turnout. But when we just gradually increase turnout, we increase the size of the gap between the popular vote and the Electoral College in our data.
Do you think then that in a high turnout environment, Democrats would be better off putting more stock in the Sun Belt than the Rust Belt?
I mean, our results here are registered voters, and I think they show that for the most part, that if you got a full turnout election, that the Rust Belt and the Sun Belt wouldn't look that different, that a state like Arizona might even leapfrog traditionally Democratic states because there would be this huge influx of Hispanic voters into the electorate there. In our polling, we have the president at, I think, 11% of non-voting Hispanics in Arizona. I think that you would see something similar in Texas potentially. So I think that in this high turnout election, if I were a Democrat and I were, you know, plotting out where I think I should invest resources, I would certainly be interested in Texas. I don't know whether it would show the Democrat ahead there, but I'd be curious because I think that helps them there.
Can I ask a question about, so in the last election, there was a lot of talk at the end of the campaign about, oh, the Clinton campaign is going to put more resources in Arizona and Georgia. So you've talked about Hispanic voters in Texas and Arizona. But what about, let's say, black voters in general or black voters in, say, Georgia? Like, what can we talk about when we talk about will there be a surge? Like, will there be high black voter turnout? Because that was sort of there was depressed black voter turnout in certain places in 2016.
I mean, I think this is a classic case where the candidate would be hugely important. You know, if Cory Booker became the nominee and did so by exciting black voters, you know, that would have consequences for the Electoral College. A state like North Carolina or Georgia would move up the list. But I have to say that in our polling, we find very little evidence that low turnout black voters are particularly excited about this election or particularly excited about these Democratic candidates. We actually think that they're fairly, I wouldn't say that they support the president, but compared to the ones who vote, they're at least Trump curious. You know, we have his approval ratings in the 20s among non-voting black voters. And I should note, by the way, we're not alone on that. When we dug into the other national polls from Pew and Kaiser and compiled them together, we think that among unregistered black voters, which is not the same population, we think that the president's approval ratings at 20, they had the president's approval rating at 20% among this group of black voters. So
what was, didn't you have like some name you proposed for like these Trump curious younger black and Hispanic?
There's what's the fighting thing that people do?
Fortnite?
Is it MMA?
MMA.
Yeah.
Something like MMA populist or something like that. I don't know. I think they're into the Trump show. I don't think that when Democrats complain about his conduct, it really resonates with them. They're not outraged all the time.
The when you guys did the story that sort of dug into the non-voters' feelings about, do you think that PC culture is run rampant? Yes, they did, overwhelmingly. I mean, there were some things that were quite
They didn't seem woke.
Right. It was not woke. And there was an interesting, I think you phrase it as like they weren't like tapped into a certain like establishment Democrat like cultural.
I think the word I used for it is socialized into it.
Yes.
I think people who live in, you know, Brooklyn or Harlem like or Chelsea like we all do, you know, I think that we live among, you know, a bunch of people who attended Ivy League schools and, you know, we all are familiar with these critiques of white supremacy and intersectionality and capitalism and so on. And I think that if you're of a demographically similar voter, perhaps a young 35-year-old male who went to community college or something, that was not a world that you entered. And you're probably you're like, what? America's white supremacist? What is that about?
It's
and it probably turned some of them off, too.
The way that you described it is that culturally, they are not with Democrats. But
well, I wouldn't say that for what it's worth. I think that, you know, by on a lot of the issues that we have thought about traditionally as Democratic cultural issues, like gay marriage or abortion, I think they're receptive to Democrats.
Oh, okay. So on PC issues, that kind of stuff, they're not with Democrats. But then on the economic issues, they're with like Bernie Sanders, right?
I think they're at least not conservative.
Okay.
They want big change. I don't know that they buy into any particular philosophy for how to do it. You know, I don't think they're considered socialists or something.
Which sidebar is what's so interesting to me about the state of the debate of the Democratic primary right now. I think it's so interesting that they're not talking more about the wealth tax stuff and like the things that the party actually agrees on. I mean, healthcare, obviously, like, you know, certain candidates throwing themselves in relief to, say, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg. That's, you know, that's good for raising your standing within the primary. But for a party as a whole, the issues that seem to pull well and resonate with non-voters or Trump voters are these economic populist issues. So it's interesting that the primary is about, you know, the 2017 litmus test of Medicare for All.
I mean, I think one thing the two Nates here agree, actually a couple of things, right? This could be a fairly broad map in 2020. Or at the very least, we don't know. Maybe they're going to be five really important states, but those five states are going to be chosen from a group of maybe 10 or 12 states, and we don't really know which ones are going to be quite yet, right? That's one thing I'm almost sure we agree on.
We agree on.
Yeah. Okay.
Another thing I think we agree on is, like, although it's a very unfashionable argument to make in certain ways now, you know, I tend to, based on my research, think that other things being held equal, an important caveat, moderate candidates tend to perform better in, not the Electoral College, just kind of in general in elections. And like your research show that was true largely in 2018, for example, every time we put a variable in our model to denote partisanship or ideology, it's really robust, right? But like that's not what a lot of Democrats think. And it's interesting to think that maybe actually some of the fallback would be with non-white Democrats.
Yeah, I expected when we did this, I mean, the point of doing the survey was to figure out what kind of voters were up for grabs and what they thought. And my prior heading into it was we were going to find a bunch of white working class, Obama, Trump, Dem 18 style voters. And we found a lot of younger, less educated voters. And I think they're really interesting to think about. You know, if you went to a public school like I did in a middle class community, like I totally know who these people are, and it makes perfect sense to me that they are not conservative, but they are not in on what the college-educated left has been offering.
Can I ask the Nates, all right, if it's a broad map, maybe give listeners an idea of what the potential states are in play. So have at it. Like where if things got really interesting, what states could be discussed a year from
now? So the six they polled, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, Texas, Georgia. There are some small states that don't have a lot of electoral votes. So New Hampshire, Nevada, I think, is certainly not safe Democratic because it's actually fairly working class, right?
Minnesota, Maine,
the first congressional district in Nebraska, or is it the second one?
It's the second, yeah.
Sorry.
No, you're good.
I think based on some of the polling, maybe you put a few bucks into Iowa if you're the Democrat and at least would want to consider.
Depending on nominee, perhaps.
On the Republican, I'd probably split between Iowa and say maybe not Ohio, which was a state that went badly for Democrats in the midterms. So we're up to like 11 or 12 states, right? Are there places I'm forgetting?
No, I think that's about right. I mean, to my mind, I don't know whether there will be a big map. I think that if there is a big map, that's the world where the Democrats have an electoral college challenge. I think that the world where one of those two options becomes clear for them, that's the world where the gap between the popular vote and the electoral college narrows.
Interesting. So one other thing that I read when we were talking about swing voters, where they live, who they are, was that you actually found that men are likelier to be swing voters than women. And we've talked on this podcast about, you know, non-college educated white women, for example, being a swing group. Can you give us a little more detail about why undecided voters at this point in time are more likely to be men than women?
Well, I don't think I can be terribly confident about the why on that exactly. I can tell you who they are. I have a theory that if you want to be outraged, the people who are most outraged about the president's conduct tend to be women. I think that that's based on the growth of the gender gap. That's based on the surge of democratic activism among women. I think there are signs of that. And I think that as a result, a group of voters who would traditionally be persuadable and who are women, they know what they think of the president. And they have sort of taken themselves out of the group of persuadable voters. That's my theory of the case. And I think that there's a group of white working class men who are not so offended by the president. And maybe they're traditionally democratic voters, in fact, who are on the president's side of these sort of post-religious cultural issues, for lack of a better word for it. And maybe they've entered the undecided category.
Interesting. All right. So there's a lot more that we're going to talk about here, broaden it out beyond just these head-to-head polls. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper. Say hello to Casper, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products that help everyone sleep and live better. Their ultimate goal is a world well slept. From award-winning mattresses to pillows, bedding, and furniture, Casper is transforming the way we sleep. With over 50,000 five-star reviews, it's the most loved and trusted sleep company. So don't lose sleep over finding the perfect bed. The four layers of premium foam are designed to provide pressure relief for all-night comfort. Need time to decide? Sleep on it. Casper Mattress comes with a 100-night risk-free trial. Rest easy with free shipping and free returns. Get the mattress of your dreams today. Go to casper.com/politics and use code politics for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics, code politics, to get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. See casper.com/terms. Customer experience and product reviews are based on casper.com, authorized retailer sites, and Google. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims was created by a guy who knows that some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. 4hims connects you with real doctors online, which could save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today, right now while supplies last and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's FORHIMS.com/538. 4hims.com/538. All right, we're back, and we're going to broaden this out a little bit to not just the three Democrats who were polled in these head-to-head polls that you conducted, but the state of the Democratic primary in general. We're curious what you think about it. Of course, we've heard each other talk about it for weeks on end now. So can you just tell us a little bit about what you see as the state of the Democratic primary, regardless of who seems the most electable against Trump?
I think that it's an open race. I think that Joe Biden has defied expectations to this point and, you know, maintaining his 27% of the electorate. I think that Elizabeth Warren has sort of inexorably gained throughout the year and has plateaued or perhaps even begun to lose a little bit of support as she's come under additional scrutiny as a result of her newfound frontrunner status. I think that she faces a number of challenges from below. I think that Bernie Sanders continues to be fairly strong. I think that he's weathered his health issues and got an endorsement out of AOC. I think that Pete Buttigieg has the potential to erode her support among college-educated voters as well. He could also trade off with Joe Biden. And I think we're entering a really interesting stage in the race where we're kind of going to find out whether these longstanding vulnerabilities that the top two candidates have is going to translate into some late changes in the race. My view of it is that both Warren and Biden are in unenviable positions tactically despite their advantage.
Why is that?
I think that one reason is Pete Buttigieg. I think that his position in Iowa threatens both of them. I think that Bernie Sanders remains strong. And I think that few candidates are going to go after Sanders. And I think that Buttigieg is going to pry away at both Warren and Biden. I also think that they face challenges from other candidates like, you know, Booker and Klobuchar, which have not yet materialized. But I think that they'll make a last-ditch effort at it. And I think all that creates a lot of pressure on Warren, who I think has a lot of vulnerabilities on electability. That, you know, I think people are going to begin to think a second thought about when they not just start polling, but just when they see her come under attack and see what those feel like and look like. And I think Joe Biden has serious financial problems. And I think that there are a lot of voters who aren't totally sure about whether he'll have what it takes to win. And I don't know how the race is going to evolve over the final stretch, but I think that in these early states, it's a really dynamic race where the candidates who don't have the lead have the potential to take it. And I think that the consequences for the rest of the map are really interesting. And I don't know how that will play out, particularly among Black voters.
Interesting. So kind of wide open race that you've described there. Claire, on the point of Buttigieg, you spent the past weekend traveling around New Hampshire with him. What do you make of Nate Cohn's idea that he could challenge both Warren and Biden?
I think it's a real threat. I mean, so Buttigieg is doing pretty well in Iowa. And I was on the booty bus in New Hampshire, where he's...
Now, what exactly is the booty bus?
It's my name for it. They do not... I guess I should say that.
It doesn't say that?
The campaign does not call it that. But I think their idea is, okay, do well in Iowa, climb up the polls over the next 3 months in New Hampshire, make a play there. And if he does well in those first couple states, maybe momentum will carry him. And I think, you know, to the idea of he could draw from Warren and Sanders, Warren and Biden, I mean, he draws people from the Biden camp who want, the nice young man moderate. They like his military record. They like the idea of cooperation with Republicans. And on the Warren side, they have, oh, he's smart, right? That's the thing. Right? So
right, college educated.
Correct. Yeah. So it's kind of pulling there. And my question about that possibility, if Buttigieg starts to look more and more like a front runner, this is hypothesizing out, how does he play in the upper Midwest? When you ask his campaign that question right now, they say, well, people don't know him yet. And so I think it's an interesting how they'll get to know him. Is it as the military vet moderate, or is it as, frankly, more identity forward, and it is, well, he's gay, and am I okay with that? And I think it's a real question mark.
I think it's a little hard to actually kind of even like calibrate where the conventional wisdom is about the primary right now. You know, I am a little bit more skeptical than what I kind of perceive as the consensus about the ability of Buttigieg or Sanders to build on early state success to build a broad enough coalition to do well in the Super Tuesday states, for example.
Why is that?
Because Buttigieg's coalition is pretty narrow cast to...
It's pretty white.
White, college-educated, not super-duper liberal, but not super-duper conservative Democrats, right? And that's like, you know, that might be a good 15% chunk of the electorate. It's not a whole lot more than 15% nationwide, and that could be a problem potentially. And Sanders more like kind of, you know, you've seen various signs of resistance, pun not intended, to Warren's candidacy recently. I would think that if Sanders were to be in a position where he were thought of as a front runner as opposed to a tier 1B or whatever, right, that you would see a lot of that. You would see a lot of movement from what we used to call party elites to say, okay, oh, maybe we have to support Warren now because Bernie would be worse, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think things, I mean, one thing you learn about the primaries is that no concern about a candidate ever totally goes away, right? I think Sanders has run.
For people, too, in general.
For people, too, in general. Yeah. It's like you're dating someone, right? I think Sanders has run like a
is
really good.
Is this politics or is this?
I'm not going to comment.
Well, there's the whole theory, right, that everyone has just one fight over and over again.
In a relationship.
Yeah. And I guess in a candidate. Sorry, continue.
I think Sanders has had a very good several weeks for several reasons, right? He got these various endorsements from three of the four members of the squad. I thought he had a good debate. I think his message has been a little bit different and differentiating from Warren. I think Warren's dealing with front-runner scrutiny. So, like, kind of four things pointing in Bernie's favor. I do think, if you were to rise, that there are a lot of voters who are concerned about his health. And that would be a hard concern to totally bury, I think, potentially. You know, another kind of more empirical question is how much do results in Iowa shift the polls nationally or in other states?
Yeah, do we know the answer to that question?
Well, I mean, this is like kind of literally like, you know, so one reason if you're listening or watching at home, you know, I'm not going to be writing a lot on the site this month because I'm kind of building our primary forecast and maybe the most difficult.
Getting day drunk maybe, and building the model.
Getting day but drunk.
He won't be, guys.
No.
There was a button there. And it had something to do with how Iowa affects the rest of the
polls. But so if you go back to like, look at Jimmy Carter, went from 2% in national polls to 37% after he won Iowa or something like that, right? Whereas more recent elections, there hasn't been as much of a shift. Ted Cruz did not get much of a bump from winning Iowa. Obama did get some and kind of fended off a loss in New Hampshire. You know,
John Kerry kind of also made his way in Iowa, right?
John Kerry, and this nomination seems a little bit 2004-ish, right? It's not the worst analogy necessarily. Nope. It is kind of funny, this whole kind of conversation about we need to bring in a savior, right? Someone who's electable or whatever else.
Elephant in the
room. I guess we're talking about Bloomberg now.
Now we're talking about Bloomberg.
Well, but yeah, it is so weird. Like if there were a big, let's say non-organic, let's say it's kind of party elders and rich people getting together, they're like, okay, we want to back Cory Booker or Kamala Harris or Klobuchar are the three where it would make the most sense, right?
Steve Bullock.
Yeah, why not? We're both on the, you know.
That's the governor of Montana, for those of you who don't know.
But if they were to do that,
I think it's crazy that he hasn't gotten a look.
It's kind of weird because, like, if it's like, okay, you want someone electable, you would not pick Michael Bloomberg, right? The people you might pick are like, where are people from reddish states or purple states where they've overperformed the national numbers? And that might be Bullock and Klobuchar might be the first two that you would pick out almost. And they're in the race and kind of being ignored.
Yeah, we don't have to spend too much time on Bloomberg because he's not.
He's
necessarily running for president, although he did file the paperwork in Alabama on Friday.
It's caused a big argument, by the way, because we actually have to have definitions for our models and stuff about who's running and who's not.
So this is a plea to Mike and his team. Just get off the pot.
Make a decision one way or another. But here, Cohn and Malone, I'll let you weigh in here. I mean, do you have anything to say about Bloomberg's halfway run for the presidency?
Not really. I mean, I don't see it.
Why
I mean,
would
if, he got, if he got in, he's got a lot of money and, you know, who knows what he can do with that, I suppose. But I do not see why he's a particularly good fit for today's Democratic Party. He also seems like the wrong guy to beat Biden, too.
Yeah,
in particular.
It's a really odd play to, okay, you have to skip the first four states. We're making a Super Tuesday play. Well, A, like, you're going to – that's a lot of states that you're missing.
A lot of media coverage.
A lot of media coverage. Biden is a pretty strong Super Tuesday play there. Like, there's a lot of southern states. There's a lot of black voters to turn out. I don't think Mike Bloomberg has a particularly strong resonance with or like relationships in the black community nationwide.
Well, you can even look at his elections in New York.
And yeah.
Stop and frisk.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just being a billionaire isn't necessarily like the right moment for the Democratic primary. No shots to Tom Steyer. So I don't know. I'm kind of perplexed by the Bloomberg thing. Like, I understand that he thinks that this is, you know, the top four or whatever are too mediocre and they're not performing well, but it's odd to think that you are the savior in that scenario.
I mean, if you take it at face value, then it's a trial balloon. I do not think the balloon has landed over particularly fruitful land. I don't know, right?
What's it's a little the hard metaphor? To say. It's, has the balloon popped?
It's balloon boy.
What I don't
deflated.
Know. What I don't know.
It didn't
is
go
like,
up.
It didn't go up.
It didn't go up. I mean, it's kind of floating out to sea.
Hanging out somewhere in Manhattan. I don't know.
The Bahamas or where is he? Bermuda? Where's he vacation?
It's at Balloon Saloon.
What I'd really like to know is kind of this discontent with the four leading candidates that clearly is not felt among Democratic voters. If you ask voters, do you like the field, then the numbers are basically tied with the record in 2008. How widespread is discontent among, again, this term party elites, right? Sometimes I kind of think it's just a bunch of like stupid rich people who live on the Upper East Side kind of thing and that talk to reporters with big news organizations because like they're people who
they live
highly themselves, right? And by stupid, I don't mean they have low IQs, but like in some sense, the higher your IQ is, the stupider you can be, right? And I think there are people who like often like are accomplished in their fields, but like don't really know anything about politics. Because if you think that, okay, hey, the answer to our prayers is going to be Mike Bloomberg or Hillary Clinton, you know, you're like, you're worried about the electability of the Democrats. Let's kind of have Hillary Clinton run again. Like, doesn't really make much sense.
Wait, question to Cohn here. Actually, so Bloomberg represents somebody who is culturally pretty liberal, economically more moderate. It sounded like, looking at your polling, there's actually more of an appetite amongst the electorate for somebody who's a cultural moderate while being economically more like liberal or progressive or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, at least on these sort of post-religious cultural issues like immigration and political correctness or whatever, I think that's right.
So, in fact, the part of the field that's not really being played on more in the Democratic primary is literally the opposite of Michael Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg.
Sure. One thing that I think is sort of fun to think – that has been fun to mull over in the last little bit since Silver brought up the prospect that the Democratic nominee has the potential to affect the – relationship between the Electoral College and the popular vote in the next election is that I think that Pete Buttigieg is the kind of Democrat who might actually help the Democrats in the Electoral College with respect to the popular vote, in part by alienating a certain segment of non-white and conservative, religiously conservative voters in the southern part of the country who are underrepresented in the Midwest. You might remember that in 2004, John Kerry actually had the relative advantage in the Electoral College. He did better in the tipping point state than he did nationwide, and that came after a campaign that was fought over gay marriage, in which George W. Bush did a little bit better among Hispanic voters, ran up the score in the white working class South. I could imagine Pete Buttigieg having a sort of a campaign sort of playing out similarly, in part for the reason Claire brought up, where maybe in the North, where attitudes are a little bit more moderate, he would be defined in the by his experience and being a relative moderate and his military views, while identity might play more prominently in the South. Just a hypothesis and an example of how things could change.
And that identity being more emphasized in the South would still work to his advantage?
No, I think it would hurt him. But the result, if the result of that, though, would potentially be to knock Democrats back a bit in some of these Sun Belt states, where the Democrats count more among a conservative set of non-white voters,
while getting the Rust Belt more in line with,
or at least not losing ground in the Rust Belt as much.
Got it.
Can I take an interlude to read my favorite detail about Mike Bloomberg? This is from a 2013 profile in New York Magazine by Jonathan Van Meter, who writes very fun profiles, and the author is at a Christmas party on in the East 60s on the Upper East Side. And later in the evening, the host interrupted me to point out the mayor had just arrived. Did I want to meet them? He goes over to meet him. And his friend thanks him for his position on gun control. Without even acknowledging the comment, Bloomberg gestured toward a woman in a very tight floor-length gown standing nearby and said, "Look at the ass on her." Anyway, I love that detail. It's so good. Mike Bloomberg. Everyone.
And that concludes our segment on Mike Bloomberg. Anyway, before we do let you go, we want to circle back to kind of a couple big think questions. And this is something that we get all the time from listeners. Obviously, you've just spent a lot of time and money polling all of these battleground states in head-to-head polls between possible Democratic nominees and President Trump. We, for years now, almost 4 years that we've been doing this podcast, have told listeners, like, a year out from an election, it's too soon to put much stock in a head-to-head poll. Don't get caught up in that kind of stuff. So much can change, etc. But you note in your write-up of your polls, you say, on average, over the last three cycles, head-to-head polls a year ahead of the election have been as close to the final result as those taken the day before. So do you think the predictability of head-to-head polling this far out has become reliably better, or is this just recency bias?
I think two things. One is that sort of in the same way that my priors have shifted on the Electoral College because of the growing polarization of the country along demographic lines. I think that the growing polarization of the country has sort of shifted my priors on how much we should care about polls far from an election, particularly with a well-known incumbent president who has extremely solid approval ratings. I think the line in my story that the polls have been so accurate is not something that I would expect to be true going forward. I don't think that as a general proposition that the polls this far out will be anywhere near as accurate as those taken the day before. I do think that a few conditions are in place now that would lead me to think that the polling today is at least, for lack of a better word, actionable. Like if I were a Democratic nominee, a Democratic candidate, or a Democratic campaign, or the president himself, I would look at these numbers and take action on the basis of it. I don't think it's irrelevant. I think that voters have a perfectly good idea of these candidates, including the president. And I think that you can act in part based on this information. There's plenty of time for those actions to change the race. You know, if you're Elizabeth Warren, maybe you can start talking about how you're a capitalist. Maybe you can start talking about how you used to be a Republican. And maybe you can start talking about how your policies against big corporations are really trying to help small businesses. You know, there are ways that you can reboot from here. But I think that it's information that is founded on something for these voters. And I think that on balance, that in the absence of a reason for them to change, that it would hold up.
What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, I mean, so look, there are a lot of things I think we say that are kind of first approximations. And a first approximation is don't worry about head-to-head polling a year in advance, right? The refinement of that, maybe you usually don't worry about it much and take it with a lot of grains of salt. But when you have cases where you have a polarizing incumbent president and a very well-known set of opponents, then you might pay a little bit more attention to it. And we do have those conditions, at least for the top three. It would be harder to measure Buttigieg or Harris or someone against the president,
that.
I think. Yeah, look, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of belief among Democrats that, hey, it's all about turnout and not about persuasion, which is another area where I know that the two Nates here agree that, like, actually, persuasion is super important.
Also, a book by Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm. And a book by Jane Austen. And like, we can debate in the abstract. In the abstract, how left or right you are, how much does that affect your standing, right? But you probably should make some effort to, number one, avoid positions that are known to be quite unpopular unless they're core to your message, right? Like, I don't think, I mean, look, people know with Bernie they're going to get, like, socialized medicine, right? So that might be a reason why people wouldn't vote for Bernie in the first place. But, like, I don't think Bernie's hurting himself relative to Bernie by, like,
talking
for Medicare for all.
Sure.
What is Bernie without it?
Yeah. I do think Bernie, when Bernie's talking about, oh, abolish ICE, I think that's electorally all downside for Sanders. And I think, you know, for Warren, I mean, Warren does seem like a bit more aware. I mean, you know, you can like Sanders for this or not. In some ways, it's admirable. He does, like, just kind of very frankly say
what
he
thinks.
Yeah. Whereas Warren will hedge. I don't know what she thinks about capitalism deep down, but she will say, no, nothing wrong with being a billionaire. You got to pay their fair share. And Bernie will say, we don't need billionaires in this world, right? I mean, billionaires are not very popular, so maybe it's not the best example. But, like, but she does show some instinct to, like, you know, she put together a Medicare for All financing plan that, like, probably involves some degree of hand-waving and some degree of, you know, but she's kind of saying, hey, look, I'm not going to take a bullet for this, right? When it's not going to pass the Senate anyway.
It's interesting that the idea that persuasion is now kind of seen as quaint, I think, by certain partisans. And you get a lot of criticism for, let's say, campaigns like Biden's and Buttigieg's, who are kind of running, in some ways, general election campaigns during the primary, where they're saying Republicans are welcome. And it's kind of about, like, my character is high, you know, is of high quality, therefore I will be president and more people will like me. And it's about, like, bringing people into the fold, where in the Democratic Party, there has been a lot of talk about, you know, people who voted for Trump are racist and we don't want them in our coalition. And it's some of the idea of persuading those voters, you know, the idea that in America to win an election, you need people who are racist, maybe, is kind of like not a popular thing, but perhaps a true thing electorally.
I mean, I think it's complex, right? I think for a long time there was a, I don't know if you want to call it like a centrist disposition or bias in the media, right? And so people would say, oh, you don't want to vote for the candidates really far left or far right. And like that was because people actually kind of, you know, on whichever morning show panel are centrists anyway, at least on average, and that's what they personally would prefer, right? And that perspective has been challenged, I think, largely to the good, where you have more transparency in what people's perspectives are. You certainly have more vocally liberal perspectives than you used to. But the empirical finding that, like, yeah, other things being held equal, that, like, more moderate candidates tend to do better by margins that, interestingly enough, like, are kind of consistent with the margins in the Upshot polling, right? We're not talking about a difference of, like, 8 points, right? It's not like, you know, anyone who's like, oh, this Democrat can win, this Democrat can't, right? They're not doing it right. But, like, could you have a 2 or 3 point net penalty for a moderate Democrat versus a left-wing Democrat? I mean, that's consistent with what I think the past research would show, right? And if you have Democrats winning the popular vote by 8 points and it's 10 versus 7, then no one cares. The Electoral College doesn't really come into play. If it's close, within, let's say, 5 points or anything under that, right, to be safe, then those differences start to become a lot more material.
Yeah. I mean, Nate Cohn, in your polling, does it become clear that one path is easier to the presidency, persuasion versus turnout? I mean, we've already talked a little bit about turnout here and that it's not reliably Democratic. If you just boost turnout, Democrats win. That is like a false idea. What else can we say from your polling about this persuasion versus turnout debate?
So I think there's a certain segment of persuadable voters who very much fit the category that Silver is talking about. They are considered moderates. They think Warren's too far to the left. Their views on the issues are consistent with that. They don't like single payer. They don't want to break up the banks. Many of them call themselves Republican. They say they've voted in the Republican in the past. Like, this is a logical group of voters who I think everyone should acknowledge probably exists.
But, like, don't like Trump on
They don't like Trump that
issues.
Much, but, like, they don't mind his policies that much, potentially. And they're willing to support Biden, but not Elizabeth Warren. Then there's a broader group of persuadable voters, less educated, not necessarily against Elizabeth Warren's views on the issues, more conservative on cultural issues. And I think that they not only are persuasion targets, but a lot of them look like the low turnout voters. It's the same basic group of people who do not neatly comport with either party ideologically. As a result of that, they neither know which party they want to vote for, nor whether they should vote, because they don't have particularly strong views about candidates who are trying to motivate them to vote based on ideologically consistent views that they don't hold. And so I think that what our data suggests is that in many cases, the two go together. I mean, if you're going to win, if you're going to mobilize and lure to the polls a young working class, you know, I don't know, let's say a community college student, I think that the kind of message that could lure them to the polls is probably the same one that would be persuasive to a more reliable voter who's, you know, a factory worker in Michigan and also isn't sure of who to vote for. And I think it's going to go together.
All right. Should we leave things there? Any final thoughts, questions?
Why did your parents name you Nate? This is for both of you. Nathaniel Silver.
So the WASP side of my family has some Nathaniel in it, and my parents like the nickname Nate. In fact, they wanted to avoid Nathan. They were quite insistent on, like, the Nate-Nathaniel dichotomy.
And to be clear, Nate Silver is a Nathaniel, and Nate Cohn is a Nathan.
That's
so,
right.
So Nathan Cohn, why Nate?
You know, I should have come prepared with the answer to that question. I can say, though, that my parents didn't call me Nate.
They called you Nathan.
They called me Nathan.
Do they still?
They do, and so do many of my friends who I knew growing up. But oddly enough, and this is another commonality the two of us have, in high school debate, I was listed as a Nate on the pairing sheets. And that's how, in a world of debate, which ultimately carried with me for some time, I became nicknamed Nate.
Oh.
We could call your mom right now, actually. You have your phone in front of you.
She's on the line right now.
It's early in the West. Who knows?
But Nate's a great – I mean, you guys would agree. Like, no one's like, oh, Nate, terrible name.
Nate's the great –
That's what they say.
Nate the Great. Nate.
I mean, it rhymes with your website. That kind of worked out.
I didn't even think about that, man.
This is the first time you thought
this
about that?
This episode will be called 530 Nate.
530
Nate.
Nate. There you go.
Anyway, we will leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today, Nate Cohn.
Thanks for having me.
Nate Cohn covers elections, polling, and demographics at the New York Times, The Upshot. And thank you, of course, to Silver and Malone. It's been fun. Glad we could do this.
Great to
Thanks,
be here.
Druk.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon. I finally memorized all of that closing. I've read it so many times. All right. Thanks so much.
Back in my day.
We just had the talkies.
Just had a blog. Just posted the blog.